Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I am the host of the show and probably the happiest man in marketing land at the minute. Why? Because I have Rory Sutherland back for episode number 2. 6 months ago, at the end of series 3, Rory came on and broke all records for the Strategy Sessions. It's now the most streamed and downloaded episode ever, the most watched on YouTube by a country mile, but that's actually quite a low bar. This show doesn't do a huge amount on YouTube, but you should watch some of the episodes. Why not? But yes, it did fantastic numbers and was an amazing listen. Rory was just doing Rory things. The one thing we never actually got to talk about was, well, trains, of all things. Rory's got some great views on why we're terrible at doing trains in the UK. If you've ever been to the UK and tried to get a train, especially if you've come from somewhere like Germany, you probably just spend your whole time with your head in your hands thinking, how do these people get this so wrong? Rory's got views. So I said, do you fancy coming back to talk about trains? And he said, yes, absolutely love to. And we almost didn't talk about trains. We got sort of three quarters, maybe a little bit more through the episode, and was like, I'm going to have to ask Rory the train question. So strap yourself in. This is another episode of Rory just being Rory. And enjoy, really. It's fantastic. Well, in my view, it's fantastic. I hope your view is the same. I would really love to know what you think of the episode. LinkedIn and Instagram are probably the best places to find me. Links to that are in the show notes. But thank you for subscribing. Thank you for downloading. It does make a huge difference. This is the last guest episode of 2023. It's been quite a ride. There's been some amazing things happening and some feedback's been wonderful. I do love to hear it. So leave us a 5-star review. Get in touch if you've got any thoughts or comments or suggestions. Subscribe wherever you are. All the usual podcast stuff. But it's now time for me to shut up. It's Tuesday, the 12th of December, 6 months after his first appearance. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Strategy Sessions one more time, Rory Sutherland. Rory Sutherland, welcome back to the Strategy Sessions.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you very much. It was a joy last time, so always happy to come back.
And the joy was all mine, Rory, all mine. So let me start with a question, slightly different to what I asked last time. What one thing do you wish you'd have known 10 years ago?
The weird thing is, I know it sounds ridiculous to say this, but I'm not sure that much has happened in the last 10 years. There are a lot of things I wish I'd known 20 years ago. So let's take that back to, I wish I'd discovered behavioral science early. I was quite early to discover it. Effectively, that I would have really got immersed in the whole thing with the launch of Nudge, which I guess was about 2008, 2009, something like that. I wish I'd just known about it a few years earlier. There we go. I mean, I sort of knew about it by dint of working in direct marketing, because if you work in direct marketing, whether you like it or not, you become to some extent a behavioral economist, because you realize that what drives human behavior is not the simple, very narrow idea of kind of incentive versus cost, you know, that actually one of the things direct marketers learned very early is that almost sort of butterfly effect, small interventions that were seemingly irrelevant to the actual virtues of the product or service being promoted would nonetheless have an absolutely monumental effect on, you know, the extent to which you actually sold. And salesmen also knew this. I mean, obviously, you know, people in sales also knew that, you know, they'd effectively, and Robert Cialdini, I suppose, was in many ways, you know, Richard Thaler gets the credit for being the kind of godfather of behavioral economics. The real godfather of behavioral economics in my book is Aesop, who was, you know, 600 years BC, but was effectively writing about, you know, things like the fox and the grapes, you know, psychological quirks of human behavior, you know, before Plato, I guess, when you think about it, if I'm right in my dates, it's kind of amazing. And also, you know, there are lots of people who've always, you know, salesmen. Adam Smith was a behavioral economist, mm-hmm. by the way. I mean, if you, you know, certainly if you read both the books, he was they're as much a book about psychology and philosophy as they are about pure economics. And, you know, and equally, of course, anybody in sales has always understood the importance of, you know, all these sort of little. I was reading about one yesterday, which is a technique in sales, which is known as the Columbo close. And the Columbo close comes from Columbo's little thing, which apparently became his great catchphrase, but it was purely added by accident. They were slightly short on a recording and they needed to add a bit more time. So they just got Peter Falk to say, oh, and just one more thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And the Columbo close is that if you failed to sell, what you do is at the last minute, you come back with what you might call as your best offer and you go, oh, and just one more thing. So at the end of what seems to be a failed sale, you come in. And in a sense, because it's towards the end of the meeting, there's less time for the person to argue against it. Right. I thought it was brilliant, you know, but it's wonderful because that I don't know about you. I was rewatching episodes of Columbo and you realize how utterly brilliant it is, because, of course, it's not a whodunit. It's what's known as a how catch 'em, because every episode, I think every single episode of Columbo started with film footage of the crime being committed, which you think violates all the rules of kind of like making a detective story, right? But it would start with footage. And the whole question of Columbo was, how is Columbo going to catch this person?
Yep.
And it was I was just fascinated by reading about the Columbo close, but I also was fascinated because one of the things I think is actually really good practice for both creativity and strategy is detective fiction. And the reason is it's reasoning backwards. And so if you ask me what's the thing I wish I'd known 10 years ago as opposed to 20, and I think this has huge bearing in terms of strategy. It's that, actually, to understand this, you've also got to understand evolutionary biology, I think. One of the most interesting things you see is there's a whole group of people who think quite alike. I was on Chris Williamson's podcast just about a week ago. And there's a whole bunch of people, including comedians, by the way, you know, whether it's Ricky Gervais or you have Jimmy Carr. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of the things they all have in common is they're all quite interested in evolutionary biology. Okay. You can tell from their content. Chris Rock, you know, there's a wonderful blog post. Chris Rock is a brilliant evolutionary psychologist.
I'm going to dig that
and
out.
What those people have is, in a way, the insight that things are the way they are because they got that way. The idea that to some extent you are where you are and you can only play the hand you're dealt. So it's a slightly conservative, small c conservative movement, I'd argue, because what you might call extreme forms of political dogma believe that your job is to effectively redesign society from the bottom up. These people who've actually had any immersion in evolutionary thinking would say, actually, you simply can't do that. Okay, you are where you are. It's that famous old joke about, you know, someone asking directions and someone going, well, if you want to go there, I wouldn't start from here. Well, here's where you are. Okay, there's nothing you can do about that. What you need is actually a philosophy not of how things should be, but a philosophy of how things can change.
Okay.
And so what I increasingly realize, by the way, and this is why I recommend reading detective fiction or watching Columbo and all those things, is it's the process of reasoning backwards. It's effectively saying we'd like to get to this place from here. It's not about designing nirvana. It's about saying what could be a bit better. Now, what would have to be true, to borrow Roger L. Martin's phrase, what would have to be true in order for this to happen? What would have to change? Now, detective fiction is reasoning backwards in a slightly different way. I have a corpse, okay? This murder, assuming it's a murder, needs to be explained. Now what I have to do is use a mixture of data and imagination, and you can't do it without imagination, by the way. This is an important point. Okay, I don't think you can do... what would have had to be true in order for this person to end up on the floor with a knife in their back? What were the pre-existing conditions, and what were the prior events that would need to be necessary in order for this thing to have occurred? And so the reason it's really important is the other point I'd make, by the way, is that one, in strategy as well as in creative, you need creativity. Okay, you need to make a hypothesis. You need to have a kind of a leap of the imagination. The second thing I think is that post-rationalisation is okay. Okay, I don't
which
think
is good because we all do it.
We all do it, and actually, I would argue that. By the way, accidents are okay. Anecdotes are okay. Okay, if you look at detective work, actually, they don't simply say. And I think science is making the mistake. Okay, if you said as a detective, the only information I can act upon is that which would be admissible in a court of law, right? There's a problem because anecdotes aren't, you know, weird occurrences, little bits of snippets of information are not admissible in a court of law. They're certainly not enough to secure a conviction, but they tell you what to investigate next. They tell you where to direct your attention. They tell you what to explore. Okay. And what you generally find when you look at true life crime, which is an obsession of mine, generally, I won't get onto Lucy Letby, where I'm not 100% convinced of the statistical evidence that led to her conviction. I'm not saying she's innocent. I'm just saying I'm not wholly convinced by that. Okay.
Sounds like there is a separate true crime podcast.
There is a separate podcast I should be on. But what I'm saying is, okay, let's take and so actually, I mean, the whole Audi end line, Vorsprung-Durch technique, ended up happening because John Hegarty was taking a bit of a wander on the factory tour, okay, round Audi, and he noticed a sign which said it, you know. I don't know whether they post-rationalized, let's make Audi German from that, or which way round it happened. But nonetheless, a large part of what you're doing is effectively trying to get lucky, okay? And you don't turn your back on luck just because the luck isn't conclusive. So the case I'll always give is Levi Belfield. The Surrey police had these various murders. He murdered Millie Dowler, by the way, but that was a much later thing. You can go and watch it in a thing called Manhunter. My brother-in-law was the scriptwriter for that. Fascinating case. But they got some tip from someone who'd been Belfield's previous girlfriend. And she just said, you know, he was my boyfriend. He was a bit of a weirdo. And I once found a copy of a magazine where he basically hacked out the faces of all the blonde women with a biro. Okay. And the victims in this case happen to be blonde. Okay. Now, that's not really evidential. You can't convict me and bang me up in jail for 30 years on the basis that I've defaced a copy of Grazia or whatever it was. Right. But it's highly significant and it's worth investigating. That's all you can say. Right. You'd be damn stupid to turn your back on that. And so this kind of scientific approach where you only act on information that's robust. And you can only publish if your information is robust. Seems the equivalent of saying to the police, anything which isn't admissible in a court of law, you must ignore. Now, I'll tell you another story about that. And I worry about this because I worry that we're becoming kind of data purists and that actually we're becoming insight. This is the thing that really frightens me about the ad industry, okay, which is the automation of media has been a disaster for creative agencies because media agencies now have a way of making money in the absence of creative. But creative agencies, their own fault in part, by the way, but creative agencies haven't yet worked out how to make money from creative or creativity in the absence of media. Okay, so you've got an asymmetry. The media agencies can go, okay, we'll automate this. We'll do some performance marketing. We'll do that. And off you go. And then the media agencies make more money. And the creative agencies aren't really being consulted on most of the actual creative work that's getting generated. Now, boo-hoo, bad news for the creative agencies. It is our fault. When we stopped being paid on commission and started being paid by the hour, we had an opportunity actually to sell creativity in lots of different ways other than just filling in the blank spaces on a media schedule, and we failed to do it. But okay, if you would just boo-hoo for creative agencies, I'd say, well, you know, that's our fault and it's our job to dig ourselves out of that hole. It's actually really, really bad news for advertisers as well. Let me explain why. In the act of deciding what to put in an ad, whether it's a TV ad, a press ad, a piece of direct mail, doesn't matter, okay? In the time-consuming, laborious act of actually producing those things manually, right? You followed a process of inquiry. Who are we talking to? What do we say? What's the most compelling way to say it? What do we focus on? what do we neglect? Where do we stand relative to our competitors? Which was very, very generative of insights. And insights are kind of the rocket fuel of marketing, ultimately. But, you know, and so I always remember this because Jeremy Bullmore more or less said something very similar, where he said that actually the most valuable part of advertising may not actually be running the ad. It may be that the questions you ask and the process you go through in producing that advertisement. And we aren't having the same, how do we sell this thing, conversations, which would go on for 2 or 3 weeks, where you discussed what was KitKat about, what, you know, et cetera, okay? And the absence of those conversations and the absence of the discipline of that process has led, I think, to a complete dearth of insight. Now, you probably know my thing, the doorman fallacy, okay, which is, you know, consultants come in, they look at a hotel, they define the role of the doorman as opening the door, which is a tiny fraction of the role of a hotel doorman. Doesn't matter. For the purposes of automation, you define the doorman as the door opener. You look at the doorman's salary, you realize that it's more than the cost of an automatic door opening mechanism, so you replace the doorman with an automatic door. You lay claim to the savings, you say, didn't we do a good job, and you walk away. And then 3 years later, you discover the role of the doorman is everything from security to recognition to the status of the hotel to hailing taxis to helping people with luggage and everything else. And you discover that actually getting rid of the doorman saved you £20,000 in relation to opening the door, but it cost you £100,000 or £1 million in relation to the actual rate that your hotel could charge and the premium it could enjoy. And I think we've done this with advertising. We've said, okay, what is an ad? It's two things, it's media and it's creative. Therefore, we'll automate the media and we'll kind of automate the creative. This will happen with AI even more, okay? And what you forget is that the real value of the thing was probably the exercise of doing it every and of having human beings doing it every bit as much as it was the fact that you produced some words and pictures that went out. I'm not saying for a second that advertising isn't valuable. What I would say, okay, is that there are probably B2B companies in particular, or companies with a very low ability to spend on media, which should nonetheless go through the process of producing an advertising campaign, not for the fact that it runs, but just for the value of actually going through those various steps and providing a period where there's scope for real insight, real imagination, really, really interesting questions to be asked. And I think we're losing that. And as a result, advertising is basically most online advertising. There are very, very few exceptions. Is completely transactional, soulless, and without any kind of human insight driving it. It's just save money on this if you do it now, right?
And the other thing with digital advertising is that the way that it can be tested. So I think in the traditional advertising way, you would test an ad pre-screening it. Whereas in the digital world, it's like, well, we know broadly what we're trying to flog. So we'll just push 10 bits of creative out, see which one works best. And then we have a winner takes all and we'll just invest in that one, which is not creativity in the traditional sense, is it?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, no. What's disappointing about it is it's only testing the most. It's not creative in the sense that even at the transactional level, I would have expected to see by now, if there were humans involved, let's just take performance marketing, okay? Basically, most emails I get from online retailers are, we're having a sale. Okay. Well, the sale is 150 years old. Okay. Right. Or save 30% on this, or spend £100 and get free shipping, or whatever it might be. Okay. Now, if we were being creative about this, even if actually the ads weren't brilliantly creative in the kind of can winning sense, you would have seen far more examples. For example, KFC, we did a creative test digitally and maximum four per customer. It was dollar chips in Australia, chips for a dollar. And the most motivating banner was maximum four per customer, which is known in behavioral science. If you create the impression of scarcity, if your offer has to be limited in quantity, it basically creates an impetus. It increases the perceived value of the offer and it creates kind of impetus. One effect of that is far more people bought four, by the way. because they felt they wanted to max out on the offer. Now, that was the result of someone creatively thinking, what are 100 different ways we could say this, and finding out which one works best, which doesn't necessarily work for brand advertising, but it does undoubtedly work at the bottom of the funnel. And it's really important, by the way, the bottom of the funnel. This is why I'm a big devotee of Mark Ritson's bothism. Now, unfortunately, the mentality with which most people buy technology is cost saving or efficiency, not effectiveness. Okay, so most people buy technology with an efficiency mindset, not with an effectiveness mindset. What I think digital probably means is that many companies may have to spend more on marketing than they did in the mass media age, because they have to spend the money maintaining the brand values, which we did in mass media, and they have to spend more money on performance marketing so as to avoid not getting depositioned at the end of the funnel. I'd also argue, by the way, you should do the bottom of the funnel first, because there's no point in feeding things into the top unless you know that the journey down is relatively unconstricted. So I wouldn't argue with someone who said, let's get our conversion rate right first and do advertising second. Okay. There are interdependencies there and so on. And you might be optimizing for the wrong audience. You know, there are caveats I've got to add there, but it's not a crazy way to proceed. But what's weird, okay, is we did a thing for Deschumes, okay? If you go to Deschumes, I think, and you pay before 6 p.m. Monday to Thursday, and you're a regular customer of Deschumes, you have a little dice or a key ring, and you throw a dice, and if you throw a six, you get your meal for free. Now, that's a much more exciting alternative to 16% off. I haven't seen companies, 16.66% off, okay? I haven't seen any companies online experimenting with that. Okay, this weekend, Black Friday, okay, is coming up. Tedious thing, along with Halloween, which are two American imports, along with a grey squirrel that we could really frankly do without, but never mind, it's too late for that, okay? I mean, nobody in Britain even knows what Black Friday is. They just know it's some sort of
makes
sale.
Makes no sense to anybody.
Makes no sense to... Why is it black? I don't even know that, by the way. I mean,
No idea.
I have no clue, okay? But you would expect, okay, if people were really doing this properly, and I'm only talking about, you know, transactional offers, you would have expected to see a kind of Cambrian explosion in really exciting offers, you know. But effectively it's sort of two, you know, it's bog offs, two for ones, it's discounts. Why is nobody experimenting with this weekend, you know, this weekend, if you buy X, 50% of the things in your trolley will be free or whatever it might be. Okay. Or why is nobody experimenting with completely, you know, I mean, not many retailers even do a version of Amazon Prime, which was one of the killer ideas, I think. It's a brilliant, brilliant idea, which transforms the frequency with which people shop with you. One large UK retailer, I think I can probably name them. I heard anecdotally that one large UK retailer offered their own equivalent of Amazon Prime. It's not ASOS in this case, which does do something
similar.
They
do have a version, yeah.
There's another one. And their average number of purchases per customer annually went from 1 to 5. As a result of this mechanism. And so there isn't even, this is what's called, by the way, P&G call it this, and it's really valuable to know. Because I always thought as a direct marketer, there's much more scope, huge scope for innovation, not in what people pay, but in how they pay. Okay. And interestingly, I never knew what the name for this was. Now, P&G, I learned, had a guy, and they may still do, but they had a guy back in the 90s, I think, who was the head of commercial innovation. And commercial innovation was defined as every kind of R&D which doesn't actually affect the product itself, but how you interact with it or how you engage in exchange with it. So a very small P&G example, which would probably count, would be selling shampoo in small bottles at airports. Okay, yeah. Or selling shampoo in vending machines would come under commercial innovation. Okay. Now, what's tragic about that is because there isn't a name for it. Most companies don't do it at all. And it kind of falls between the cracks of kind of pricing and finance and marketing. But a really, really good commercial innovation like Amazon Prime can be absolutely decisive to a business. And I'd expect to see a lot of innovation in terms of how do you make an offer really exciting? What else, what could you do? You know, even just buy something this weekend and you know, win this or whatever. But there's, you know, I mean, I've come up with about three or four, you know, that idea of actually one in six people wins their shopping for free. Okay. You know, that would really, really drive excitement. Okay. And I would have expected to see more of these experiments. Now, I suppose one theory is people have experimented with them and they didn't work. I don't believe that's the case. I think it's just a total lack of the imagination. And people are just sort of following best practice. And so everybody else's Black Friday sale is, you know, everybody's Black Friday sale is like everybody else's Black Friday sale.
We tend to follow the herd, don't we? Which as marketers and often you recruit people from within the industry to hop from one place to another. So they just bring the same idea.
Well, it's really interesting because in anything relating to human perception, best practice is or benchmarking may be a bad idea. Not always, but maybe a really bad idea. Because what you do is you basically become invisible and uninteresting because the human brain pays attention to what's unexpected. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this in relation to an interesting concept, which is kind of what I call premium economy, where it's discretionary premiumization. So I'm a very big fan of the Moxie hotel chain, which is part of Marriott.
I saw this on LinkedIn, which I was wondering, are you now, you're an influencer by the looks of that post?
No.
You'll be all over TikTok shortly.
It's slightly embarrassing because, I mean, you know, there's a similar one which is offered by Aloft, I think, which is part of Intercontinental Hotel Group. There was Citizen M, okay. I mean, I happened to encounter the Moxie first because the Moxie dates back to 2012 as a chain, but there are 60 of them now in Europe. And weirdly, because I was having an eye operation in Lausanne and needed a place to stay, which wasn't absolutely egregiously expensive, which isn't always possible in Switzerland, I stumbled on the Moxie Lausanne and just really loved it. I thought this is actually, I didn't expect to like it as much as I did. And having then on Twitter done a little bit of kind of advocacy, it was interesting because a couple of my other friends said, okay, well, your recommendation is at least good enough for me to try it. And they had a similar epiphany. And the point about it is that you strip out all the extraneous shit that people don't really care about or which are often done for sort of status signaling purposes. You know, you would actually get rid of the doorman because it's not that kind of hotel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You don't even have a check-in desk. You don't have a concierge. You check in at the bar, which is a bar and coffee shop in the middle of the ground floor. The ground floor, there's also an ironing room, by the way. I noticed they don't do laundry, but you have a kind of ironing room and laundry room if you wanted. And it was intended as a kind of youth brand. It's actually a bit more expensive than that because they tend to be in quite good locations. But the interesting thing is the Wi-Fi is great. The bed's perfectly comfortable. There's a really good TV. Your room's pretty small. It doesn't even have a wardrobe. It just has a kind of a sort of trellis work thing on the wall where you hang your jacket or your stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I mean, I'm probably not staying there for a week anyway. But the ground floor is basically a bar and coffee shop, a bit like a kind of cooler, funkier version of a WeWork, which means that when you're not in your room, which is after all quite small, watching TV, you can basically chill out there with a laptop, get on with work. You could spend the entire day there. To be honest, you could probably stay the entire day there, even if you weren't staying at the hotel, right? But you could spend the entire day there basically getting on with stuff without feeling like a weirdo.
Yeah.
And it's open 24 hours. The bar, and there's a sort of snack bar, little shop. If you want toothpaste, you buy the toothpaste. And it's just incredibly well thought out. And it's just really, effectively, what's interesting about it is that it does, it's what I call, someone else in the comments to that LinkedIn article made the point that there's an airline they used. It's a low-cost airline somewhere in Europe where, you know, it's basically a cheap airline, but they had a sandwich on board, and they said it was just an incredibly good sandwich. You can imagine what it is, like tiger bread or, you know, brioche bun or something. But they said it was a sandwich, the kind of thing you'd pay £6 for in a fancy cafe, okay? Mm-hmm. And they said, so if you do everything basically, but you do one thing so astonishingly well that it basically dominates human attention, you have this wonderful middle ground between effectively what you might call between first class and economy, premium economy is effectively what I was looking for. And What's interesting about it, there's another hotel which is in Los Angeles, which does something similar, which is called the Magic Castle, I think. And their famous thing is, next to the swimming pool, they have a thing called a popsicle hotline. And you pick up this sort of red telephone, and then someone comes out and gives you free ice cream for your kids. And the rest of the hotel is actually fairly, it's perfectly nice. By the way, often people go, oh, the rest of it's terrible. No, no, the rest of it's good. The rest of it's good enough so you don't notice there's anything bad. But then you have one kind of outlier thing that you do disproportionately well. Now, what's interesting about the Magic Kingdom or Magic Castle, I can't remember what it's called in LA, is that it comes like number 8 on TripAdvisor among the best hotels in Los Angeles, despite the fact that actually, you know, the building, the location, etc., are nothing amazing, right? I did notice one other thing, that when you get your laundry back, they wrap it in brown paper and then put some, what's it called? What's that stuff? They then put a sprig of scented herb or something, probably rosemary or something like that, on top of the laundry, which is just a nice touch, okay? Mm-hmm. It's just that extra thing you weren't expecting that you now notice, you know? And so I think that, you know, it's interesting because I think there's a big market opportunity there for people who are increasingly annoyed because, as I wrote in The Spectator last week, you tend to have this problem that markets bifurcate or they polarize. And the reason is that although in theory we're making a trade-off between price and quality, an awful lot of purchases are either quality-driven or they're price-driven. You know, you buy your car insurance as a distress purchase, you buy it on kind of price, okay? If you're buying a pair of sunglasses, you basically buy it on brand.
Yeah.
And this creates this annoying thing where there's actually a, you know, I always said, you know, the problem with John Lewis, it's not their fault, it's their customer's fault. Because John Lewis is providing what customers say they want, which is good quality at reasonable prices. But then when you actually look at what customers do, they kind of want Prada or they want Primark, okay? Depending on everything, not only economic circumstances, by the way. And it's worth remembering that one person's, you know, that what's luxury for one person is cheap for another and so on and so forth. But by and large, you still get this kind of polarization.
And market research, sorry, go on.
And market research doesn't capture that because people want to sound sensible because they don't want to say, I'm going to pay anything for sunglasses that make me look cool and who gives a shit. And then, you know, and equally, they're not going to want to look like cheapskates by just going, I'll buy whatever's cheapest. So market research doesn't really capture, I think, this polarization because people are going, I want good value at reasonable prices.
No, you don't. I mean, it goes back as far as Henry Ford, but, you know, about asking people what they want. But that's not to say I don't believe in market research. I fundamentally
do. It's just got to be done in a very oblique way. Yeah.
Yeah. It's how you design it.
I'm slightly skeptical about groups because what you're capturing in a group is the way someone wants to appear to a bunch of strangers.
Yeah. Now, I do love a focus group.
I'm not saying don't do them. And there are loads of things. If you're behind the glass, you can read the body language. You can do all that sort of stuff. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you can also look at the dynamics in the room, which can be really interesting. But there is a fundamental risk that, I mean, there was a lovely case. We were doing research on online book buying. Now, this would never come out in a group, right? But it did come out in depths, which is after we've been quizzing this guy who was quite a heavy book buyer. Okay. For, you know, it was something like 45 minutes or something. Eventually, the effort of lying becomes too great. And this guy said, can I be absolutely honest with you? He said, I'm not massively into reading books, not as much as my book buying suggests. I've just found that if you've read a couple of Ian McEwan's, you can pull a better class. Okay. But no.
The truth comes out eventually.
Let's be absolutely candid. There is probably... there's an awful question to ask, which is how cultured would men be in the absence of women? It's a kind of terrifying question, isn't it? Because would we just be basically just watching Jason Statham films in our underpants? You know,
with a single chair in a room and a big TV and a fridge.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly it. Yeah,
that is kind of it. And it is. It's a bit like Aristotle Anassis's thing. You know, without women, all the money in the world would be valueless. You know, that effectively understanding that there was a kind of, you know, peacock purpose to a hell of a lot of wealth acquisition. How much that's true of cultural acquisition is a really interesting question. Would men actually be basically pretty crass without the civilizing influence of women actually exercising selection?
There's probably one thing
I'm weird about, actually, the only thing I would say, my tastes are pretty demotic in lots of things. I'm totally unconcerned by going to fast food restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'm pretty easygoing and unpretentious about lots of things. Weirdly, I'm a bit of a cinema asshole in that I basically stopped going to the cinema except for Oppenheimer for about 3 years because of this flaming comic book franchise bollocks. You know, I'm a 57-year-old man. I mean, you know, I don't want any comic gear. Also, I like my films to obey the laws of physics, which is why Oppenheimer's particularly good, I suppose. I don't want things.
Spider-Man might not be.
I can cope with Game of Thrones, because being Welsh, obviously dragons are not actually mythical creatures. I could just cope with that level of weird, okay, in Game of Thrones. Okay, you know, it's like parallel universe stuff. But the superpower shit, I can't cope with at all. I just don't want that stuff at all. Can't do it.
Well, I would love to dig into that, but the reason I invited you back was to talk about trains. And if I don't ask you the question now, we're going to run out of time.
We've got time.
Trains. When I retire in a number of years' time, I'm going to pack my worldly goods into a carrier bag, put too many pens in my top pocket, and go and stand around train stations looking at trains. I think it's in my future somewhere along the lines. I do quite enjoy a conversation.
By the way, a really interesting point, which is that we really, really like them. Okay. And that's not irrelevant. Okay, yeah. The reason I probably go to Amsterdam on the train, if I'm being honest, okay, is it doesn't... I lived quite close to Gatwick. I might claim it's environmental reasons, but to be honest, it's because I enjoy being on a train and I like everything about trains. Also, it's a change from flying.
Yeah.
But the fact that we like trains is not an irrelevant factor in the same way that I'm a huge devotee, which is just about train-related, of the Heathrow pod parking. Have you ever tried that?
I have not, no.
So it's a car park. It's called business pod parking. It's about a mile and a bit from Terminal 5, but you park your car there. There are then two pod bays where you go press a button or press a screen. The pod opens its doors. You get in, typically alone or with your family. You don't share pods except at moments of very high demand. And the little pod just, you say, I want to go to Terminal 5. You could, if you want to, go to the other end of the car park, okay? But you typically say, I want to go to Terminal 5, and it then scuttles off and drives you there, and then the doors open Star Trek style and deposit you at Terminal 5.
Is this the same as the lift in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, isn't it? It sounds exactly like
that.
Well,
it goes where you want it to go. It goes horizontally. Yeah, so basically, the reason it doesn't go that fast, it's probably 30 miles an hour, but the distance doesn't really, you don't really care, okay? It's on elevated, sometimes elevated tracks. It travels on unique tracks with little guide rails, but it actually, the pods are self-propelling and with pneumatic tires, and they just go woo, and you said that, okay, this is very embarrassing, but I had a colleague who's more serious minded than me, and he was 60 years old, and he admitted to me that every now and then he'd turn up for the Heathrow pod parking and they'd say, I'm terribly sorry, sir, but even though you booked, the pod parking is actually completely full, so we've upgraded you at no extra charge to the short stay. Now that's like a £40 more expensive parking option for free. Mm-hmm. And his reaction was not, oh, that's great, thank you very much. He said, my reaction was, but I wanted to ride on the pod. Okay. And actually, one really important factor about that is the joyousness of a mode of travel in terms of the extent to which it uplifts you. And the pods are very, very uplifting as a mode of travel. Because A, you're on your own, because you've got off a plane, particularly in arrivals, right? You've got off a plane, you've been through airports, you're kind of sick of being with other people. And so you're getting into your own little pod and just sitting there is the thing. And they're clever, because if the battery gets low, they scuttle off. I think there's a kind of predictive algorithm. So in the morning, there are more pods waiting at the car park. And in the evening, when people fly in, there might be more pods. I mean, you know, actually, in the morning, it's complicated because there are people arriving from long-haul flights. But generally, I think, you know, they've got a sort of learning algorithm. There's a predictive element to where they sit, and they go and charge themselves if the battery gets a bit low, and they kind of queue up in a cute way. So, you know, you might have two pods in a kind of holding bay. So as soon as the person in front of you goes off in their pod, a little pod will kind of scuttle around the corner and come and pick you up. But if you're at Terminal 5 and you're in arrivals, follow the signs to pod parking, okay? It's free. I mean, it's completely unpoliced for them, except by CCTV. But try it, because it's the point about it is that it's just really nice. And I don't think this is why I'm obsessed with trains, which is it's the collision point between an incredibly reductionist quantification culture about punctuality, time, journey time, speed, capacity, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, an almost sort of aspergic obsession with what is quantifiable on the side of people who actually design and conceive and fund transport, and a completely different mindset on the part of people who use it, which is, I wouldn't mind if, you know, look, I mean, the point I made is that the High Speed 2 asked the wrong question. They started off with, how do we transport this many people in this time from London to Manchester? No, so wrong question. The question asked is, how do we produce a railway so enjoyable that people feel stupid driving? That's the question you should have asked.
So okay? I've been watching the whole HS2 debacle roll out on the telly over the last number of months. And very briefly, if you're not in the UK, HS2 is a high-speed 2. We were due to build a high-speed rail link, the sort of thing that you've probably got in your country anyway, from London to Manchester, Liverpool, and the other way through Bradford, Leeds, and possibly even at some point up to Newcastle. Wonderful. The cost has overrun so much that they've now cancelled almost everything of it to the point where it's pointless. This has been playing out in the news over the last number of months. And every time I see it on the news, I scream at the TV, why is no one talking to Rory Sutherland?
Well, there was someone did actually relay what I said to, I think it might have been the Shadow Transport Minister, who I'm delighted to say has also read my and Pete Dyson's book. It's more Pete Dyson's book than mine, but it's called Transport for Humans. But the reason I got fascinated with trains is it's the San Andreas fault between marketing thinking and what you might call reductionist engineering thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I mean, I think the Heathrow pod, because psychologically, if you look at the prices for pod parking, it's like 70, 80% as high as the cost of short stay. If you look at the longer stay parking, which has a bus transfer every 10 minutes, that's like 30% of the price of short stay, right? Well, people are voting with their wallets as well as their feet here. Now, what that says is that anywhere you want a parkway station, you don't actually need, literally, you don't need the car park to be next to the station. Okay, park and ride would be completely transformed, I think, if you had a pod system rather than the bus system. And there's something weird about it, particularly with luggage. We really don't like buses very much. Okay, I mean, there's a weird thing that if you replace a bus service with a tram service, you get something like, you know, 80% higher ridership, even if the frequency and speed isn't much changed. What it is could be social status, could be all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, we have this really interesting question, which is that no one is factoring in to any of these equations what you might call basic desirability. Now, the desirability of a train may be only tangentially or very poorly correlated, okay, with speed. What it might be very highly correlated with is like, I'll give you an example. There's a weird train out of Cannon Street, which I use as the last train home from London. And it goes from Cannon Street to Otford. The reason I use Otford Station is basically because you can, there are no ticket barriers. And you can, that's not because I'm cheating. It's just I hate the ticket barrier thing and that, you know, you end up missing a train because you're queuing for a ticket. The car park's really nice and there's a good coffee shop, okay? Those are the three factors that basically decide me on using Otford. On the way back, why I like that late Cannon Street train is because the train's in the station for about 30 minutes before it departs. So, you know, when the pubs close, as it were, I mean, you know, or whenever I'm coming back from something, you head there, and basically just go and get on the train. Now, for 20 minutes, it's not going anywhere. I don't care. I'm sitting there in complete comfort. I'm doing my Wi-Fi.
Nice and warm.
Yeah. Nice and warm, okay? Now, by contrast, what trains tend to do is imitate, the Eurostar does, this is, it imitates the most irritating facet of air travel, which is that you're corralled in a holding bay until the very last minute. You know, Now, okay, I get that because aircraft have to maximize efficient turnaround. But if you literally had an airline which said, actually, the plane opens up for boarding, you know, you just built in a bit of inefficiency. The plane opens up for boarding 20 minutes early and you can just go and sit down and get your shit together. Okay, and everybody boards kind of by stroke. This was the case with that wonderful British Airways service from London City to New York, where they had a kind of micro lounge. It doesn't exist anymore, I think, the service. It was business class only. But then they kind of said, well, you know, the plane's leaving in half an hour, but you're free to board now if you want. And so people just sort of basically sort of drifted towards the plane. Boarding was completely stress-free. I mean, there are a load of other reasons for that. Obviously, there were fewer people. It's a smaller plane. But the actual pinch points aren't the bottlenecks, and pinch points are often psychological bottlenecks. They're not really kind of transportation bottlenecks at all. And this is why I refer to trains being fascinating as literally that San Andreas fault line between engineering thinking and marketing thinking.
Yeah. Now, we're coming towards the end. And if you've listened to either both episodes with Rory on this podcast, what you've probably taken away from this is that you come at problems in a slightly different direction to most people, whether, you know, against the engineering mindset, as it were. You have a course called the Mad Masters. Is this the place to go to learn more about how to tackle problems in this way? So tell us about that and about it. Is the time to talk about your new book? Are you allowed to talk about your new book?
I'll talk about this. Yeah. What I want my new book to be about, although it will take a different shape because the process of your strategy formulation should be recursive and iterative. It shouldn't be top down. In fact, probably there's a wonderful book called Bottom Up Marketing by Rees and Trout, I think it is, where they argue that you take a tactic and you elevate it into a strategy. You might argue the Moxie Hotel's kind of doing this. We take this one tactic and we actually then amplify it. Rees and Trout, by the way, Positioning the Battle for Your Mind and Bottom-Up Marketing were two of the kind of epiphany moments in my marketing journey. But as I said, the thing I wish I'd known 10 years ago is actually do things backwards, genuinely. And doing things backwards means you start with a consumer and you work up to the bloody business. And what most businesses do is they're optimized for reporting upwards to aggregation, data aggregation, to report to shareholders. Mm-hmm. And what the consequence of this is, it's created a kind of Soviet-style capitalism, which is all about top-down planning rather than bottom-up strategy. And I think it's... as you know, I'm a huge Ritson fan. And one of Ritson's great phrases, which I borrow and use all the time, is the average is the enemy of the marketer. But when you're taking data and you're aggregating it for the purpose of averaging, what you're doing is destroying the very information, you know, the anomalies, the outliers, the exceptions, the counterintuitive things, the Simpsons paradoxes, all of those things. I won't go into that because that's another podcast, Simpsons paradox. The direction of causation, all those things, okay? When you aggregate up, you create a kind of moron's eye view of the world. So this is why I think that strategy should be a kind of post-rationalization, because it should have a what if we did this? This thing seems to be surprisingly successful. What if we did a hell of a lot more of it and made it a talking point, okay? That's a much more interesting, illuminating, and I would argue profitable conversation. What if we actually make the talking point this, not that? Okay, what if we price something like this, not that? What if we do this, not that? And you can test it, you can look at existing data, you can ask for data, because the data that's most readily available is probably not the most useful data. Okay, you've got to do your police inquiry thing where you kind of listen to a word on the street and you look for, you know, anomalies. But this process should fundamentally be done from the consumer perception back, not from business planning and capacity planning forwards. And yet, because of the complete decline in influence of marketing, we're the only people, shortly before he died, Peter Drucker, it was more or less wheeled onto stage. He died in his 90s, so he must have been amazingly old. And they said, you know, what's the one thing you'd like to say? And he said, do not hand the keys to your business to finance, because they only look at the past. They're not looking at the future. And that was sort of Drucker's last, not his last words, but his last recorded words. And that's absolutely right. We've handed the keys effectively to finance and planning and given them over to people with an efficiency mindset, not to people who are focused on effectiveness and meaning. And we don't actually have a phrase, by the way, emotional efficiency, but we should have a phrase, emotional. I kind of did it as a Google whack where you search for it as in inverted commas. And there are hardly any cases of anybody using the phrase emotional efficiency. But emotional efficiency is basically obtaining the greatest perceived advantage or differentiation through the least expensive or costly possible means. It strikes me as an absolutely obvious thing to pursue. And on trains, for example, making a train faster if it's already going at 140 miles an hour to Manchester is unbelievably difficult. It's even exponentially difficult because the faster the train's already going, saving 10 minutes becomes harder and harder and harder. You've got to go disproportionately faster to save 10 minutes on a 150-mile journey. Okay, or whatever it is, 200-mile journey. But emotional efficiency, if you actually had fantastic coffee and a brilliant bacon sandwich on board, or you did, you know, you just did one thing amazingly well.
Wi-Fi, that's all anybody wants.
Well, funnily enough, you can do that because I met a guy who worked for a company where they did a test where they basically had perfect Wi-Fi on a train. The reason is that the companies who provide the train Wi-Fi are too mean to pay the operators for a large-scale connection, a proper connection. It isn't actually the coverage, it's that the bandwidth frequently gets strangled because they're not prepared to pay the premium for it.
But if we were going to pay 80 billion, is it, to knock 30 minutes off?
Don't even get me started. Okay, you can make
a
two-hour journey useful, productive, or entertaining, or you can make a non-entertaining journey 40 minutes shorter.
But still non-entertaining, yeah.
But, you know, what you know, shit is still, you know, shit is shit, whether it lasts 2 hours or whether it lasts an hour and 20 minutes, you know.
Well, wasn't that David, a riff off David Abbo and the shit that arrives at the
speed of
light?
Shit that arrives at the speed of light is still shit. Yeah,
I love that phrase. Well, listen, hopefully we've got to the end and hopefully no one's thinking this has been shit that's it lasted longer than the speed of light. But, Rory, thank you very much for your time. There's a link to the Mad Masters and all the information about that. Sign up
Thank
for the
you very
email.
Much.
The email's fantastic and well worth it. And then sign up for the course after that. And Rory Sutherland, thank you again for your time today.
It's been an absolute joy. Anytime.